is time to put away the bias, the lies, and deceit and bring forth real talk from real people about real news. Providing the out loud truth and capturing the essence of a new generation all in a fast-paced hour. This is Viewpoint This Sunday.
Welcome to another Viewpoint This Sunday. This is Malcolm Out Loud. Well, the Woodward book, The Atlantic Story, Trump's DNA, well, the scandals, they keep on coming. And more so as the election draws closer, the question is how many more will you see between now and November? Well, President Trump is playing mostly on offense. You see, the economy is rebounding and the numbers are tremendous. The peace deal in the Middle East is historic as the president sees the country pulling through COVID and on a positive rebound. Former Vice President candidate Joe Biden being questioned as to, is he using a teleprompter during these various interviews? And why isn't the media questioning his policies? As the Biden campaign still tries to keep Biden hunkered down, but trying to figure out how to make the leap. What's most interesting is, will that debate come off at the end of the month? We shall see. Also, the rapid decline of America's cities, COVID panic before, now, and after the election. Got some very interesting information for you there in the program. But let's start right here at the top here and talk about reshaping the election with claims of racism. And help me welcome on here Alveda King. Well, evangelist Alveda King is the executive director of Civil Rights for the Unborn with Priests for Life and founder of the Alveda King Ministries. She's the niece of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And it's a pleasure always to have you on, Alveda. It's been a while since we've talked last.
Good morning, Malcolm. Happy Sunday to you and your listeners. And I'm glad to rejoin you as well.
Yeah. So listen, we start here with the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis and Jacob Blake in Kenosha has brought race relations and racism to the forefront. Specifically, they're reshaping the 2020 presidential race, many would say. So listen, let's start here straight out. Is America a racist nation? And is systemic racism alive and well in America?
The human race is often a very racist group of people. And I say it in this way, and I will bring it into America in just a moment. However, racism comes from a fabrication that human beings are separate races. Science proves that we are one blood. In the Bible says of one blood, God made all people. So there's only one race, the human race. So social justice and a social gospel, that's man-made concepts, will say your race and my race need to get along, or my race is better than yours. There's only one human race. So here in America, systemic racism is based on that theory, kind of even almost like the Darwin concept, where there are different races of people and there are not different races of people. So anyone in America or wherever you live on the planet, if you feel as though you belong to one race and someone else belongs to another race and you're all human beings, then you are a racist. So I tell people, racist, or you could be a racist regardless of your skin color, just thinking you're a separate race. Now that's hard to grasp. I've got a new book, We're Not Colorblind, with Ginger Howard, and we explain all these concepts. So look at notcolorblindbook.com to get more on that. So is America a racist nation? There are many racists living in America erroneously thinking that they are separate races and therefore either inferior or superior or at least different. I took a long time to answer that. But
well, isn't racism more reflection on the person who has those feelings than those that they are pointing to?
It's sometimes mutual as we do that. For instance, I don't know what your ethnicity is. I know that I'm part African, part Irish, and part Native American, and I've had the DNA test and all that. So I don't know what your ethnic origins are. However, if you think that you're one race and I'm one another race, then if we both think that, then we are both functioning from a racist perspective.
Right. Well, we have a connection. I am part Native American, part European, and part Platonian outside of this world, actually, Alvin.
Amen. Yeah, absolutely. Yes.
Yeah. So listen, if Ferguson was another turning point in our country back in 2014, why do you think now we're having these race wars on our streets again after so much time has passed?
Race wars will continue to erupt in every generation. I actually went to Ferguson and prayed with Jonathan Tremaine's ministry and George Floyd's uncle prayed. We were in a prayer tent and we all prayed together. Then you come and fast forward to what happened with George Floyd. That was Brown, I'm sorry, in 2014. Then George Floyd being choked to death. And then now you have Jacob Blake, who was shot in the back 7 times. Now, all of those are African-American men, but these types of things happen across communities constantly, and they will continue to erupt, which is why you need voices like mine saying, hey, we're one blood, one race. Martin Luther King Jr. did that during his lifetime. We must learn to live together as brothers, and I'll add as sisters, or perish together as fools. And he taught that. My dad, his brother, A.D., my granddaddy, Martin Luther King Sr., all taught that out of one race, one blood, Acts 17:26. If people don't hear that, then this other concept just keeps flaring back up.
You bring up a good point when you say that, when you bring up, of course, Jacob Blake, and we went back to Michael Brown just a moment ago, and then, of course, George Floyd, and you mentioned these are young Black American men. But whereas there are incidents every day on our streets in America with all kinds of ethnicities with our law enforcement, I mean, it's a common theme because the evil, the criminal contempt and the evil components is always out there. I mean, it's a fight of good and evil, clearly.
Always.
Having said that, Elvita, but you notice the media, they focus strictly on the young Black male. They don't focus on the young white male or the young Hispanic male or the young Jewish male. It's strictly that. That is really the essence of racism, isn't it?
That is. It's the division, and it's called playing the race card, stirring up angst and emotional upheaval because of a misconception regarding race. And that's called playing the race card. So when we see that race card played, we have to step in. You know, Blake's mother, Jacob Blake's mother, did such a beautiful prayer and made beautiful points. She says, don't burn up your neighborhoods and destroy and do all that in the name of my son. He wouldn't want you to do that. That's not Christian. That's not godly. Right. That will not answer. But we do know that it's usually anarchists that come in times of upheaval and come into communities and they burn the Black stores and the houses and all of that. And it looks as though the Black people are mad and just destroying their own stuff senselessly. That's not true, because these Black businesses that are destroyed,
right,
that really hurts the whole community. And that's not those business owners. I'm mad, so I'm going to burn down my
business. Right, right. But Alvita, the people who are burning it down are not just the young Black people. There are many of them, the young white people. It's both.
No, that's
races.
What I'm saying. The anarchists.
Yeah, that's
they
right.
called them. In my day, although I'm 70 now and I'm still here, still doing the work, but when I was a young woman, we called them outside agitators, and they would come into the community with Molotov cocktails and all that and burn our stuff. We didn't do that.
Yeah.
They did it.
Yeah, yeah. All right, so listen, in the 2016 election, when Donald Trump made history and became the 45th president, he received 8% of the Black vote, you remember then, right? Now, at that time in the race, 88% of the vote went to Hillary Clinton. Now, there's a lot of posturing right now coming into 2020. And one of the significant points is the Black vote. That probably could very well determine the next president of the United States. Tell me where you think President Trump has positioned, number one, with the Black community, Black America. And two, what do you think the percentage could potentially be of this vote for President Trump?
Well, let me mention, I think that 8% was a little bit low. I don't even think that's what was reported, and I understand that. But there were more who actually voted for President Trump, really, in the 26, you know, when he became president.
So you think the numbers are better than that even?
They were even better then, and they will be better again, because people are actually waking up. It is amazing what people are saying and doing. They're simply saying, no, he's done a lot for unemployment. We had the lowest unemployment in history in the Black community and in America, period, under Donald Trump, before before COVID hit and these street riots hit. And the economy is already recovering. And President Trump has just gone overboard, I'd say, and he did it for America. He didn't do it for personal gain, because he was already a billionaire and famous and all that. He did it to help America and the historically black colleges and university, the criminal justice reform, sending people who committed nonviolent crimes. And Joe Biden actually in the 90s did all that to load the jails up for personal gain. Mm-hmm. So all of that that has happened, African-Americans are waking up, African-American men especially, are waking up to the fact that, hey, I was able to help my family get a house. I was able to help my mom. I was able to help my family. I was able to pull in a check and I didn't get it. Jobs came back from overseas and now I'm working. People are getting that. Not just, you know, all blue collar can see that too. And it's amazing. And the middle class is stronger. It's amazing what President Trump has done for life, pro-life. He's the greatest pro-life president America has ever seen.
Yeah, yeah. So could he get 25% of the black vote?
It's a very high possibility. It actually can happen. And I know that the numbers are already reported at low numbers. You know, I have so many African-American friends that'll say, don't tell anybody, but I'm voting for Trump. I voted for him last time. Because when you vote for President Trump, or if you're like me, I'm a Christian evangelist. I don't endorse political candidates anymore. But yes, I did vote for President Trump. I will again, and I'll say that easily. But when you say that, you get ostracized in your own community. People yell at you, do mean things to you, say profane things to you, and it's terrible.
Which really should go against everything we stand for as America. And we've lost the diversity of thought, the diversity of opinion, and the diversity of our beautiful country, which is really, Elvita, I would suggest, what makes America great. And yet we're struggling today. For all, everything that makes us unique is what we appear to be struggling with. This really is the ultimate fight we're in right now. And you can feel it. It's a little different right now. This fight I reference as good and evil, you think?
Malcolm, could I suggest that we've not exactly lost it? It's been dampened down. People are quietly holding on to it, and you will see that at the polls. So all is totally not lost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I really know that for sure. So I'm just encouraging people. But really now, there's a great effort through these fake mail-in ballots.
Yeah.
To steal the election, and there are other efforts to steal it. For instance, the nursing homes. You've got them gonna take all kind of ballots over to the nursing homes where people are captured and locked in because of COVID, and scare the, you know, just scare them, and ask them to go ahead and vote for Joe Biden so that they won't die, and that's not true. So these fake mail-in ballots, and if somebody shows up at your house with a handful of ballots and tells you to give them out to your friends and mail them in, those are fake ballots. You have to vote absentee or in person or early. You can vote early, absentee, or in person on election day.
As Black America now looks, and all of America looks at this 2020 election, do you think more progress has been made in Black America under the Trump administration or the 8 years under the Obama administration?
When I consider both administrations, and I would tell people, when President Obama was Senator Obama, he was running for office, and God revealed in my heart, he said, he's going to win. And I was like, but God, do you know what he is? And God kind of chuckled, I imagine, and said, I know exactly who, you know, soon to be President Obama is, and he's going to be the president. So I was not surprised when President Obama won. I did not enjoy his policies. I did not like the rainbows on the White House confusing God's purpose, procreative marriage and all of that. However, there was a reason God allowed President Obama to be the president. He is no longer the president. And so that's what I have to tell people in my own community. He's not the president anymore. So stop that. We have President Trump, who is rebuilding this nation and helping this nation. Yeah. And so the gains that America received in the first 4 years of President Trump are just amazing. He did ask, what do we have to lose? But he showed us what we had to gain. And we have many, many, many gains. Yeah. And Black America knows that. All Americans know that. So this is a season that God has allowed us to have President Donald John Trump, who gave up everything for America. Yeah. Don't forget that. So we just have to know that each person, because, you know, I think that's in Romans 13, nobody gets office if God doesn't allow it. And God allows this or does it for different reasons.
Yeah.
However, I don't challenge Christianity. I don't challenge anybody's. I have to look at mine every day to say, Lord, am I right now? If I'm not, straighten me out.
Amen to that. One of the big challenges we're having is the decline of America's cities. And it is a constant threat I talk about on America Out Loud. Elvita, how do we change the course in our cities?
I'm going to be participating soon with a group called The Return. I think it's thereturn.org. And there's a big prayer movement in Washington, D.C. on the 26th of September. And returning to God. I did a book around 2014 or so, America Returned to God, Come Back to God. And so we have to come to God. And even the atheists, if you're listening, Mr. and Ms. Atheist, there is something greater than every human. And we do need God. America needs God. President Trump says, we don't worship government. We worship God. Our money still has, in God we trust. We still say we are one nation under God. So all of that is true. And our answers will only come by the hand of God. And that's the difference between 9/11. We just passed 9/11. And people said we will rebuild, but they didn't say with God's help, or let's turn back to God. They just said, we'll rebuild. We're strong. We're great. We'll rebuild. But this time, with COVID and the street riots and the economic upheaval, we've got a president who's praying in the White House, he and his wife, leading America and you know, reading the Bible and asking God. So that's what we have to do. We absolutely have to return to God.
Let's get to the top stories now. And want to bring on here for the first time on the program, Frank Vernuccio joins us. He serves as editor-in-chief of the New York Analysis of Policy and Government. He's the co-host of the American Political Zone TV and the Vernuccio Novak Report on Talk Radio. Now, Frank, it's a pleasure, first of all, to reconnect and have you on the program here. And let's talk about these election surprises here. So 2020 election is heating up very quick now. We're starting to see a series of these Trump scandals. And in very many ways, this is reminiscent of 2015 and 2016, when you were seeing the drip, 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 drip of all of these things. We were actually, you know, thinking at one point, how much more could there possibly be? And, you know, this is where they just throw the book and everything about it at the candidate. So let's start with Woodward a moment. So supposedly there were 18 interviews. A lot of people are questioning in my ear in past days, like, why would the president give 18 interviews to anybody, let alone Woodward, a Washington Post reporter? Do you think that was a mistake with President Trump, or was it a good move, first of all?
Well, I think the president has been attempting as much as possible to get beyond the noise of a somewhat biased media to reach out to the public as much as possible. Woodward, of course, has a distinguished history, and I think the president was impressed with that history and wanted to reach out using Woodward's interviews as a vehicle to address the public.
All right, these statements about the fact that he was playing down the coronavirus has upset a lot of people. This is when, of course, he did lock down travel to, as we know, to China and to Europe and all of that against the masses, including Biden and everybody else, said he was out of his mind. But remember, Frank, he's been labeled a xenophobe right along from the beginning. So this would go along with that strategy, you know.
The president tried to do two things simultaneously. One, take very tough action in cutting off travel to and from China, but two, to assure the public that this is not going to be the end. This is going to be something that we can survive. We have to use common sense and we can endure.
Yeah. And really, strategically, I mean, what's wrong with that? I mean, he's a president. That's a patriot. Clearly, you don't want to alarm the country. And if you look historically at our presidents, I think you can see there's a pattern of that with every great president. They're not out to create panic in the masses. Their job in leadership is to calm the people. And I think hopefully everybody agrees with that. But this other crazy story, Frank, now with the Atlantic, this was the really pretty in your face. You know, people would argue how the president has done a great deal for our military. And I mean, I don't think that's really an arguable point, but they may try. But this story in The Atlantic is quite something here, where he said Americans who died in war are losers and suckers. And I've been seeing stories in the last many days that suggest that, well, that would be something President Trump would say. But, you know, Frank, again, in reverse psychology, I mean, if you were going to set anybody up, you would certainly look and at what their words are and use them against them. What do you think specifically about that Atlantic story, the president and the military?
Malcolm, you and I are both in the journalistic business. We both do news. Neither one of us with a story this sensational would quote anonymous sources. I think both of us would look carefully to find out some verification of it. The fact that Atlantic Magazine, which has a history of rather outrageous statements about President Trump, is using anonymous sources tells you what they think of their own story, that they have no veracity to it. The John Bolton statement, I think, is fascinating. John Bolton is no fan of the president. They had a pretty serious split. For John Bolton to say that there's nothing to the story, that this is not something the president said, is significant. It puts to rest the story altogether. I don't think there's much more to go on with it. With the key source like Bolton saying it's wrong, there's really no legs to the story at all.
Yeah, that was striking with Bolton. That surprised a lot of people. And in many kind of a weird sort of way, Frank, it kind of brought Bolton's credibility back, is what I was thinking. You think?
Oh, it certainly did. Again, in law, there's a concept called a statement against interest, which is always accepted as evidence in court. And certainly what Bolton said was a statement against his own feud with Donald Trump. And of course, Bolton had a sense of humor about it when he said, hey, if it was true, I would have put it in my book.
Yeah, that's right. And I'm not saying I would certainly trust Bolton for the next round, but that's another story for another day there. All right, this other scandal, again, we're seeing them about every 3 days, every three and a half days, there's a scandal. This other one with that came out about a year ago with the advice columnist E. Jean Carroll in the Bergdorf Goodman Manhattan luxury department store. And this was pretty outrageous. This is where the president was accused of raping this woman. That came out some time ago. But what's interesting about this past week, they're pushing the story to the top again. And again, you're going to see all these things resurface again, I would imagine, between now and November. And this time, they want, Frank, a DNA sample from President Trump for their case. Do you see President Trump honoring that request?
I would suppose he would not, frankly. But the problem with this story, of course, is that it brings back memories of the Brett Kavanaugh nomination, where particularly the same type of sex scandal was used to discredit the nominee. I think the public is becoming almost immune to this type of thing. They realize a lot of this is sheer nonsense, and I think they will react to this in exactly the same way as they reacted to Brett Kavanaugh.
Is there any end in sight on these scandals, in your opinion? Serious question, I mean. Are we going to see, how many more between now and November? This is their strategy, is it not?
Malcolm, forget about between now and November. You can forget about, you can hear about this between now and the next 4 years if Donald Trump is reelected.
That's a good point.
We've already heard from Adam Schiff that if Trump is reelected, he intends to reopen the Russian collusion hearings. So this is going to be going on forever. The problem is with tactics like this, eventually the public gets exhausted and begins to tune it out. And even worse for the Democrats, they begin to turn on the accusers for constantly coming up with false stories.
Frank, that is so well said, what you say there. And I think that's exactly what may very well happen here, because at some point you just get tired of the drip, 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 and you turn it all off, which is the danger here. And I think a lot of people have already started to do that. All right, so listen, this other one is really fascinating. There are a lot of claims now about, we've seen how they have been running the Joe Biden campaign. Very, very scripted, very, very scripted, every detail, in fact. And what's happening now is there are claims that he is using a teleprompter, even with these sort of interviews and casual responses, that somebody is talking into his ear, or he's got a prompter there telling him how to answer all these questions. And his press secretary was very, very offensive to this. He had a very interesting exchange, TJ Ducklow, with Brett Baier, actually, that I think is worth playing for listeners in case you did not hear it.
End with this. Has Joe Biden ever used a teleprompter during local interviews or to answer Q&A with supporters?
Brett, we are not going to engage. This is straight from the Trump campaign's
talking
points.
Yeah, they're using it.
And what it does, Brett, is it's trying to distract the American people.
They talk about it every day. Can you say yes or no?
That's because they talk about it every day, Brett, because they don't have a coherent strategy.
Well, you have an answer. Yes or no?
Brett, they talk about it every day because they don't have a coherent argument for why Donald Trump deserves re-election, deserves four more years. We know that he lied to the American people. We know that he has not shown leadership during this crisis, and they are desperate to throw anything they can against the wall to try to distract from that fact.
I understand, but you can't answer the question.
Brett, I am not going to allow the Trump campaign to funnel their questions through Fox News and get me to respond to that.
All right, Frank, so you'll hear the audio there of T.J. Douglas, press secretary, and never did answer the question. What are your thoughts on this teleprompter discussion?
Well, you know, you have to go by precedent. Joe Biden has always been a campaign type of guy. He was never an intellectual politician, but he was a great campaigner, loved to rub hands with the public and so forth. The Joe Biden that we're seeing on the 2020 presidential campaign trail is a different fellow altogether. He's reclusive. He doesn't want to reach out to the public. And that leads to a lot of thoughts that perhaps there is a reason why either he or his handlers have made the decision not to put him out there in the public. Certainly his answers don't seem to be the type of answers, the type of tone of voice, the type of spontaneity that we always saw from Joe Biden during his 47-year political career. The question is legitimate, and the fact that the campaign refuses to answer it lends a lot of credence to it.
Yeah, it's very telling, and I think it would leave probably most Americans with the concept and idea that, well, he is using that prompter at all times. And again, it comes back to a scripted campaign, which I like what you point out is very uncharacteristic of Joe Biden and his long, long political history. So think about it in those terms, and it should tell you plenty, actually. Now, while we're on Biden a moment here, Frank, you know, this is a very interesting election strategy that I truly haven't seen before. And I think we should take a moment and talk about it so that everybody understands. The Biden campaign is actually talking about, I mean, this is pretty wild, raising taxes. And they're talking about raising taxes across the board on so many. So he called this past Wednesday, by the way, for higher taxes on U.S. companies, foreign income and special tax breaks for any kind of domestic manufacturing. He's all of a sudden appealing to blue collar workers or trying to. And, you know, this is on top of the corporate tax increase he had been proposing. He wants to reverse the tax changes in the 2017 tax law that was signed on by President Trump. He says here, Frank, and I quote, "I'm not looking to punish American businesses, but there's a better way. Make it in Michigan, make it in America, invest in our communities." Now, Frank, this is really an about face for a politician who has never supported that in his 47-year career in Washington politics. What gives?
Well, if you go back to the pre-2017 tax reform, American corporations were paying the highest taxes of any of our developed trading partners. And they were bleeding jobs out of the country en masse. The Trump tax reform started to bring those jobs back. Considering the dependence of the Democratic Party on blue-collar voters, something has to be done to try to attract them back in. Unfortunately, Joe's campaign really has taken the wrong tack. The voters are sophisticated enough to know that you're not going to bring jobs back by making it harder for corporations to operate within the United States. One of the weak points that the campaign has, of course, is that blue-collar workers, not union leaders, but blue-collar workers are drifting pretty solidly to the Republican side in this 2020 campaign. This is an attempt to bring them back. Unfortunately, it was done in a heavy-handed manner rather than going towards better trade deals or fighting against China. They want to tax American corporations. It's not going to work with those blue-collar workers they're trying to bring back.
I don't know of too many Americans who would vote for somebody who wants to raise their taxes. Traditionally, Americans do not enjoy paying more to Uncle Sam to spend on their behalf. So, you know, maybe some of the socialists like that program, but most people do not. It'll be interesting to see. All right, Frank, this is really incredible, this next story. And it is the historic Middle East peace deal. This is 2.0 now, just within the past few weeks. This now is with Israel and Bahrain. And so the president and the White House have released a joint statement with the Kingdom of Bahrain and the State of Israel, announcing establishment of full diplomatic relations between the two. And this was the deal, Frank, right after the United Arab Emirates there in Israel. We are now getting into some uncharted waters here. They say there's more coming. And the whole idea is to open up relations between the Jewish nation once and for all, and to acknowledge it at least. Continue, and this plays a lot to the Iran strategy, which will never bow to this kind of a thing. This is historical in nature here, right on the heels of the election. What are your thoughts on this?
You know, Malcolm, I'm not sure what I'm more fascinated about, the fact that this is an historic advance for peace in the Middle East, or the way the American media has tried to bury the story.
Wow.
If you look at this in terms of an historical context of the Middle East, nothing like this has ever happened before. It's an extraordinary accomplishment for the Trump administration. The press has done somersaults trying to avoid discussing it. This is a politically dangerous advance for the Democratic Party, and I'll tell you why. If you look at some of the key electoral college vote states, they have heavy populations of Jewish American voters. If they find that this administration has done so much for peace and for the security of the state of Israel, those states are in real danger of drifting out of the Democrat camp into the GOP camp. It could be an utter disaster for the Biden campaign and for Democrat candidates in general. So the media understands how deadly this is and has not only decided to try to bury this story, to bury that other part of the story about the president being nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize.
Yeah, he's been nominated for two of them now, incredibly so, Frank. You know, you hit it before I could even ask you the question. You were on it. I so appreciate that. And speaking about, of course, the media, and Frank is so right when he says, how do you bury a story like this? I mean, just think about this in this terms, people. This kind of a story under a Bill Clinton administration or a Barack Obama administration would have been the biggest news since we put peanut butter on bread. I mean, it would have been out there like there is no tomorrow. And yet you hear nothing of this. And he's so right when he says burying the story here. The other interesting takeaway, which he also pointed out, is the Jewish American vote. You know, we just talked up top of the program with Alveda King about the Black American vote and what could happen there. Now you've got the Jewish American vote coming into the election. Wow. What I'm speaking about right now is an absolute game changer, without a doubt here. Big, tremendous thank you to Frank Vernuccio here. So great to have his voice in the mix here. As we continue on with Viewpoint, friends, we have a special series coming up right now next, The Rapid Decline of America's Cities. And then we have a really must listen to segment on the COVID panic before, now, and after the election with the expertise and knowledge of MDs that will join us. Dr. Jane Orient and Dr. Elizabeth Lee Vliet will be here. Let's pick it up in just a moment here as we pause. More Viewpoint in just a moment.
The America Out Loud Talk Radio app is on Android or Apple. It's the perfect way to listen in to the new generation of talk shows and hosts who are ready to inform and inspire.
Spreading the out loud truth from sea to shining sea. AmericaOutloud.com is the voice of liberty and justice for all. This is not a fight of Republican versus Democrat. It's not a fight of rich versus poor, old versus young, man versus woman, gay versus straight. It's not a fight of black lives, blue lives, Hispanic lives, or white lives. This is a battle of good versus evil.
It's a fight for the soul of humanity. We are the vision of the voices, America Out Loud Talk Radio. We're seeing the rapid decline of America's cities, and a very interesting three-part series as well that Professor Larry Bell, who's going to join me now, has been the author of. He's an author and a commentator, writes for Newsmax as well. This third part of the series was very interesting, Larry. Progressive politics hastened the tragic demise of great American cities. And you talk about the nonstop street marches and significant loot-ins following the outrage over, again, Floyd. And but we've been seeing this happen for some time in a lot of our urban centers. Our cities have been in trouble for a long time. New York, Philadelphia, Chicago, Cleveland, Milwaukee, St. Louis. Again, Portland, Seattle. There are so many. Los Angeles. Countless cities that are in trouble. It's a trend that is being argued that kind of reflects this, like a part of modern urban progressive governance towards maintaining civil order, political incompetence. That's a hell of a way to say it, actually, political incompetence and intellectual incoherence. I like those words because they say exactly what's happening in our cities. So a lot of this is failed policies. Do you think people are recognizing right now that the failed policies have come to a hot point right now with COVID and with the unrest in our cities? And how concerned should we be?
Well, we should be very concerned. And the cities you mentioned, I mean, think of New York and Los Angeles and Seattle and Portland and so on. These are, I think, as you mentioned, Democrat or very liberal cities, have been for a very long time. And people are voting with their feet. They're moving out. And most particularly New York. And New Yorkers are going more to Florida. And the Californians are moving more to Texas. And
so what will happen to those cities? What will happen to those cities as they, I like the way you say voting with their feet. So what will happen in those cities as people exodus? What's going to happen?
Well, there's a combination of influences. One is the fact that we've had, the coronavirus, which really turbocharged a trend for working at home and telework, which was draining a lot of the reasons for large corporations to be in metropolitan areas in the first place, because now they can decentralize. And a lot of those people aren't going back. They're finding that this telework is really working perhaps much better than anyone thought. And of course, that revved up everybody getting tech savvy, so they have their offices at home, and it's really totally changed this. Mm-hmm. But when people can have that opportunity to live where they want, a lot of them are moving, of course, to the suburbs and rural areas where land is cheaper, and they can live near grandma, and they can they go there to move next to good school districts and so on for their children, I think a lot of the service industries or the organizations that depend on them, think of hospitals and think of large companies, that legal firms that have paralegal employees and so on, are moving into the suburbs and rural areas. Some of them will bring their politics with them from the city, but I think increasingly, as you hear this big whooshing sound as people move out of the large cities, that is going to also take with it these cities' tax bases. And being Democrats, strong and strongholds as they are, of course, their response is, well, we'll raise taxes. And then you realize they don't have any place to raise taxes from. So, hey, we have a good idea. Let's annex the suburbs. They've got lots of money. And then the question is, there's going to be pushback, I think, from the suburbs. Mm. And then the suburbs will say, wait a minute, we don't get city services, and we don't want your problems, and so on. So I'm sorry, big cities, you guys are on your own. And I think there's going to be a demographic shift and a political shift. And then when we see the riots and so on, and the destabilized areas moving, elements moving and, going into the suburbs, which is, after all, where the money is, will people wake up? And when there's pushback, how far will it push back? And
let me go further with a couple of thoughts here, because the strategy you just lay out and that you just discussed, which makes sense,
sadly, would indicate to me that the denominator of all that is that our cities are probably not coming back, probably not today, probably not tomorrow or anytime soon. If you take everything in consideration of what we're dealing with right now.
Are the cities going to come back? My guess is that to the extent that they come back, they will be redefined. I think cities are being redefined in the sense that a lot of the big movement that brought people to cities in the first place was kind of a tech movement and marketing movement. Cities, the place you had to be in the metropolitan area in order to really do business and greet and meet folks and so on. Well, with the internet generation, that's not as important anymore. And then you see, well, the cities grew up around airports because and transportation because they were able to, you know, since they were central, they depended upon access, you know, people being able to come in globally and so on. And so a lot of the things that attracted people to the cities in the first place, the convention centers and the airports and the entertainment. Well, who's going to go to entertainment areas if you're not safe? You know, you have these same concerns with New York. Love Broadway, and Broadway's closed down now, mm-hmm. probably because of COVID, that now as the other elements come in and they become unsafe places. It's not a place where middle America's gonna wanna bring her children anymore. And so there's gonna be a redefinition, I think, of what cities are, and they'll be redefined around many technological influences that will continue long after COVID.
Yeah. This is a significant, not only election issue, but it's a significant issue for America moving forward. In these metropolitan areas, if the big companies are not there, if the big corporations are not there because the people are not there, then you have that shift, and that's going to impact everything. It's going to impact the landscape from every aspect, from a dining aspect to, like he says, the theater aspect to life and quality of life aspect. It's going to the tax base aspect. So now we're talking about a complete shift here in the way that America looks. This is kind of a very interesting pivotal moment here. I want to invite you on Monday to my daily show, The Voice of a Nation, a special show on Monday, 6 p.m. always, weekdays, to hear us on the during the week. And on that show, we're going to do a deep dive on this program. We have a couple of guests coming on that program, and Professor Larry Bell will be back with us, but also a lot more with this decline of America's cities. But in the meantime, that series, go look at the third one, is live on the front page right now at AmericaOutloud.com. Progressive politics hasten the tragic demise of great American cities. What I want to do now is switch it up and talk about the COVID panic. Dr. Jane Orient is here. She's an executive director of the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons. This is the AAPS. And she's president of Doctors for Disaster Preparedness as well. So, Dr. Orient, I start with those headlines. There's a lot of confusion. I'm confused. I can imagine that about all listeners are confused. So we see these headlines all the time about cases rising. The media constantly wants us to know that cases are rising. When we talk about herd immunity, this has never been properly addressed from the beginning, as far as I can see, from really the officials of the government or the CDC. Help us understand, please, what is it we're looking at when we talk about cases rising? Is this a good thing or a bad thing? And how does that connect with herd immunity?
I think we don't really know what it even means, because a case used to be a person who was sick or a person who died of something. And now it means a person who has a positive PCR test. And we are doing 800,000 of those a day. They have a significant number of false positives. Some labs have even reported that 100% of the tests are positive, which has to be just fraudulent. It can't be that big a mistake. And what it may mean, since the tests are so sensitive, they're taking a few fragments of a viral RNA or DNA from way back in your nose and magnifying it many, many times. And it's been found that if you magnify it more than about 30 times, it's impossible to grow any live virus out of it. You're probably picking up fragments of an old cold that you had a long, long time ago, and the virus itself has long been dead. There are just some pieces of its DNA left, sort of like you might find some DNA at a crime scene. after the criminal has left. And it really is meaningless to know the number of cases. As to deaths, people are dying still, but the deaths are way down. If you look at the curves, like any virus disease, we had a rapid increase in cases and then a decrease. Since the statistics on deaths are confusing too, because if there's a positive test, even a motorcycle wreck victim will be called a COVID death, or could be. But if we look at the only reliable statistics, the all-cause mortality, that is back down to normal, which means that by any definition of a pandemic, the pandemic is over. There will still be some cases of COVID-19, just as there are cases of the flu, right, or cases of any other disease that you'd care to name.
Right. We're not getting that information from authorities because they're still suggesting that the pandemic is in its full first round, and there will be a second round, which we'll talk about in a little bit here. But there's, again, what I don't understand is, if we lock people down, which still there are mayors and governors and folks that are still wanting their cities and towns to be locked down, if we get everybody wearing masks, and that was the concept from the beginning, how do we ever, I still don't understand how we get there. To me, I would think it's a positive thing. Now, why am I looking at this wrong, that you have more cases? Don't we, if we have more of those, isn't that sooner we get over the hurdle? Or am I just looking at this wrong?
Well, I think a lot of epidemiologists would agree with you that the way that the population gets immune is that people get a very mild case, and then they're immune and they can't pass it on to others. Some say that maybe Sweden has passed this, and maybe even New York City has passed this point at which the virus is not going to propagate very much, because a significant number of the people who are likely to be exposed are immune. There's also plenty of evidence from looking at numbers from all over the world that lockdowns and masks really make no difference at all, that the curve is going to do what it's going to do. It goes up and then it comes down, regardless of the timing of these draconian things you put in place. And you can argue that if you isolate people, their immune systems are going to be weakened. Right. And once they come out of this and get exposed to all the germs that are in the world, they're going to be much more likely to get sick.
See, that's it right there. That's it right there. You just hit the nail right on the head for me. I just want people to understand what you just said. I mean, this seems to be very logical to what you're saying. If you've got everybody in this, you know, sit down, lockdown position, and then you're exposed to it all you're doing is delaying the inevitable, which I never really understood this whole lockdown thing. You've got these numbers from the CDC. You know, people are getting very aggressive about how many people really died or not. We're in the 190, 200 range here now, or whatever. But again, it's already been documented. They're putting COVID on death certificates for all kinds of reasons, and mostly because it's profitable for, and I hate to say it that way, but for a lot of hospitals and doctors alike. And I mean, the CDC just claims 6% are truly COVID-related, but the 94 had other underlying conditions. Why it's so hard for the media to understand that?
I don't know whether they can't understand it or they just really love having people in a state of fear and the government gaining more and more power that it may never give up. But, you know, they're clearly not interested in saving lives, because they're not talking about things you can do to improve your immune system. Even Dr. Fauci admitted to vitamin D and vitamin C being protective. He hasn't been taken down from Twitter yet for saying that, but he might be. Or about hydroxychloroquine, how this has been very successful in all the places in the world where it is used and encouraged. And the death rate may be, you know, only 20% or 10% of what it is here, where it's very, very hard to get this cheap and very safe medicine.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or other medications that have been found to be effective. We're not talking about that. All we're talking about is death, 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 and fear. And we never had this with the flu epidemics in the past, like the Asian flu in 1958. We had Woodstock then. We didn't lock the country down. We got through it. And that was much, much worse from the standpoint of number of people killed than what we're having now.
That is so well said. So last point I want to make here is the vaccines, and I'm hoping you can help us out here because, again, a lot of the studies, a lot of the research I'm reading here, like Merck, Pfizer, Moderna, there's a lot of these people that are pushing really hard. Some are suggesting that the third trials will, about skipping them or not. Will they be properly vetted? I mean, Fauci just came out just the other day here and said, we'll probably have one by the end of the year. I mean, and they're all pushing really hard. Are we going too fast, too quick on this thing?
Well, we'll find out, I guess, if they approve a vaccine and people start dying from it. But the fact is that hydroxychloroquine that we have now, it is cheap. It is easy to make. It's been available for more than 65 years. Is probably much more effective than a vaccine, maybe 90% effective versus best 50% or 60% for a vaccine. It's been proven safe in hundreds of millions of patients for 65 years. Already one of the vaccine trials has paused because somebody got paralyzed, which has not exactly had the same impact as, well, the person became ill or came down with an adverse side effect. The person became paralyzed from transverse myelitis, which affects the spinal cord, and we hope that she'll get better. Well, people need to know, have full disclosure about what the situation is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is the worst behind us, do you think, on this thing?
Oh, obviously the worst is behind us. You look at the death curves from all over the world, right, on the information that's readily available on the internet, and the deaths have peaked and they're coming down everywhere. The all-cause mortality rate is back to normal virtually all over the world.
Wow. Joining me on the program now is Dr. Elizabeth Lively. She's an independent physician specializing in preventive and climacteric medicine. I think something that people need to be aware of. I'm starting to see a lot of headlines again, and this is what she just addressed, actually, is the fear, fear, fear. And Fauci, Anthony Fauci, comes out and says, the United States needs to hunker down for fall and winter. His quote is this, don't ever, ever underestimate the potential of the pandemic. And don't try and look at the rosy side of things either. I mean, I just couldn't believe I read that quote from Fauci. And then on top of that, I see another message here that says, just today here, hospitals prepare for nightmare scenario of flu and coronavirus striking at the same time. Oh my, aghast. I mean, again, we're seeing this horrible drumbeat of bad and negative news come. What do you think about this fall and winter business in Fauci and what we're prepared for or not prepared for?
Malcolm, I absolutely think they are ginning up the fear ahead of the election. They are trying to keep people at home, prevent in-person voting, influence the election. Everything is coordinated to design to keep the public in fear.
One of the headlines I'm seeing a lot in recent days again, and people are questioning why we have so many deaths here in the United States. Now, we're hearing this a lot, and we're in comparison to a lot of other countries. It's suggested that, and here's what's important that people understand about this. Let me just make sure everybody gets it. What they've suggested, many media sources and pundits are saying, coronavirus, that this is all bad and it's lack of leadership coming from the White House is the narrative and the message that is being beat out there. Now, based on the amount of deaths and that, and you hear Biden saying that X amount of people have died and, whatever. Now, when you look at that and you look at the other countries we're talking about, what's really fascinating is that I think when you dive a little deeper into this, you begin to understand that a lot of these countries, they are dealing with COVID in a different way than what we are here in the United States. And there are so many countries, but let's take the one that was in the news in the last many days. India, for instance, is a perfect example of what I'm speaking about. So in India, they have very low deaths. They've had a great success, very low mortality there, great success. But there's a difference in how they're treating COVID. And this is really critically important because this is a major election issue in 2020 as they try to pin this on Trump. And yet Trump is the one who's tried to give them the answers, but yet they're using that same medicine to get back at the president. Why are other countries having such success, whereas we've not had that same success here in the United States, Dr. Blee?
It's very simple. And Dr. Orient mentioned it. There have been lots of us physicians on the front line that have been talking about the approaches we need to take since March. And it's very clear. The countries that have lower death rates have been using hydroxychloroquine, azithromycin, and zinc, maybe a couple of other medicines. Ivermectin is used in South America. They use it early. They treat at home. They treat within the first few days of symptoms. All of your listeners with any common sense at all know that we treat every illness in the history of medicine as early as we can. That's especially true with viral illnesses, herpes, shingles, the flu, Tamiflu. You use it within the first 48 hours. We are being prevented, and it's bad leadership, but it's not President Trump. It's the Democrat governors that led the way, and it's Democrat-aligned Obama appointees in some of the three-letter agencies, the NIH, the CDC, and the FDA, long career entrenched bureaucrats plus political appointees in those agencies that are absolutely sabotaging early treatment in the United States with the effective medicines that we have. We've got a handful of them, and I put the article that Dr. Peter McCullough from Baylor wrote outlining the algorithm to treat early at home. I put it in my editorial that's on your website, and your readers can and listeners can check that out. Every patient I've treated, I've started within the first 2 or 3 days of symptoms. They're over it by 3 or 4 days later.
And they've had success.
They have not gone in the hospital. They've gotten well with the triple therapy, azithromycin, zinc, and hydroxychloroquine, which is what India has been using since the beginning.
Amazing. These headlines that I'm reading about the flu and Fauci, and again, this coming together. Again, we were hearing that early in the spring as well. Are you terribly concerned for some other big uprising here? Or as Dr. Orient suggests, are we kind of coming to the end of this thing?
I think Dr. Orient is quite correct in presenting the statistics that she did in the last segment. All-cause mortality is back to normal around the world. The number of deaths from COVID are going down. That's the important number. You can harp on number of cases till you're blue in the face. That's not the key point. And the more people that have had a mild illness and get over it, the better we are towards the herd immunity that's going to make the virus die out, burn out, as you say. And this is the point that people need to understand. Plus, we have treatment. There are studies showing that hydroxychloroquine helps reduce people getting sick from seasonal flu as well as from COVID. I'm using it prophylactically in treatment for my patients as they need, as is appropriate for my patients. And I have many patients who are high risk who have chosen to go that route to reduce their risk of getting sick during the flu season. If doctors would stand up for what is medically correct and stop kowtowing to fear, we have the tools to use for our patients.
This was a great segment. A tremendous thank you to Dr. Elizabeth Lee Vliet and Dr. Jane Orient. I mean, you've learned several things here about COVID just now. And if you take this to heart and you help us get this out there, which is really the key to this, you'll understand that all the fear that's being pushed out there and propagated is nonsense, and it's nonsensical. It doesn't make any sense. But again, in a political season, it does make lots of sense now, doesn't it there? So that's where you have to really drill down. Lots to talk about there. What a terrific program here. Let me tell you about the second hour now. We have so much coming up here with Michael Johns in just a moment here. State of election, Biden's policies in blue states and how that may turn on him. You see the politicizing of professional sports. You're going to see it now like you've never seen before in your life. And it's going to turn a lot of Americans off potentially here. And the other story here is, why is America's the American enemy, Iran, working so hard to support Biden? You see in these stories that they are pushing the Biden campaign. Iran, we're speaking. Now, why would you think that Iran would want a President Biden? I can't imagine. Thank you, my fellow Americans, for being on the mission with us. It's time to get involved and get loved.